Welcome to the AXA-XL Healthcare Risk Insights Podcast. I'm your host, Shalay Hendrickson, Head of Healthcare here in Bermuda. Today's podcast will focus on active shooter preparedness. I have the privilege of sharing this podcast with Mr. David McRoberts. David is a career law enforcement professional, having served 30 years in a variety of public safety capacities. As a now-retired Sheriff's Department captain, David served as the commander of the tactical response team for his agency, helping to create safe resolutions to very high-risk law enforcement incidents throughout his career. David is also a Wisconsin State-certified law enforcement instructor for the Wisconsin Department of Justice, Division of Training and Standards. He is a national trainer and an advisory board member for the International Law Enforcement Educators and Training Association. David has delivered a variety of training topics to thousands of law enforcement officers and protective service personnel, as well as private citizens. As a trainer and presenter, he has been a featured speaker at many professional conferences and workshops. David, I'm excited to chat with you today. Welcome to the podcast.
Thanks very much.
There has been over 160 related shootings in over 150 different hospitals since 2000. Sadly, this number is on the rise. Large and small healthcare facilities have been affected in both urban and rural areas. An active shooter can pop up in any city, in any county, at any time. David, share with us how a healthcare organization can prepare for an active shooter event.
Healthcare organizations in all varieties, hospitals, clinics, freestanding clinics, or medical offices for that matter, are very, very unique. By their design, as in hospitals' cases, they're 24-hour day operations. Some outsourced providers also have extended hours. But what happens with a healthcare facility is that inherent to its design and its operation, it's 24 hours a day. It's a soft target. In our terminology in law enforcement, we call it a soft target because there aren't enough levels or layers of perimeter security, typically. And that's by design. As an example, probably the most visible entity in a hospital is the emergency department. The emergency department's a 24-hour day operation, and it is open to the public because the public travels there when they need care. So inherent to that, being a part of the community and being prepared to help the community, it's not apart from the community. So typical layers of security that we would see, the different security barriers aren't there. And that makes it difficult. The open spaces, the many doors and windows that exist in a typical healthcare facility or a medical clinic are problematic in terms of pure security. And I should go on record to say that when we talk about these things, there's any number of people, there's any number of topics out there on the internet, other publications and what have you, that talk about active security preparedness. So there is no true expert in these things. Now, I may be an authority and speak with some conviction because I've been involved in these incidents throughout my career, but there's no real authority or an expert, rather. So we just give it our best shot with regard to what has occurred, how best to prepare for that, how to be proactive, how to train. And in the healthcare environment, probably in addition to the physical limitations and the constraints that we run into, is the overall mindset. And it's not meant to be critical. It's certainly not a disparaging comment. I met my wife in the emergency department, so I have a special place in my heart for that. But we need to understand that the mindset is one of caring and lending assistance. It's not one of being proactive or security-minded, typically.
Thanks, David. Motive for an active shooter can range from grudge, revenge, suicide, or maybe a person with behavioral health challenges. How can a healthcare organization identify warning signs of either disgruntled employees or patients?
Well, when you work in this industry, in law enforcement, public safety, it wasn't until after the horrific events of 9/11 that I heard this phrase actually coined and repeated. But if you see something, you have to say something. If you hear something, you have to say something. Too often, what happens is people present different ideations of what they may be proposing to do or what they feel they should do, little things that they say, little things that they do. changes in their behavior. Simple conversations that project vehement unhappiness towards management, as an example. Minimalization of anything that may have been affecting them directly in the form of a disciplinary action. Apathy, they distance themselves from others. The list goes on and on, but I think hospital security needs to work collaboratively with human resources. And I believe that more recently we see the development of threat assessment teams. Those work. I believe they work so long as they are comprehensive and so long as there's some action taken based on findings if there's a potential threat. So the warning signs are, they run the gamut of human emotion. We've all had workplace difficulties. If we spent any time in the workplace at all, not every coworker is pleasant all of the time. There is employee turnover. There is disciplinary action that takes place for non-compliance. People sometimes harass or practice bullying techniques to other coworkers. So all of those things collectively need to be assessed and documented in some cases. And if there needs to be an intervention, an intercession, if you will, then it needs to take place. But the whole effort here needs to be proactively, certainly not reactively.
Right. Thank you. Can you tell us a little bit about the function of threat assessment teams?
Sure. The implementation of threat assessment teams is not particularly novel, but I think it's had a resurgence in probably the last 8 to 10 years, whatever, where members of management, people in human resources, people in risk management, and other key staff members and stakeholders that represent the full gamut of a facility's operation meet and they discuss problem issues. If there's an implied threat or if there is belief that a threat is about to develop, whether actual or perceived, it needs to be discussed. Now, these assessment teams are pretty sophisticated in some cases. They have scoring matrices, check the box, if you will, depending on if somebody presents a particular behavioral trait and then whether or not you get a cumulative score high enough that would trigger the next intervention. But I guess what it is, in a nutshell, is people of a like mind sitting together to be certain that issues that are playing themselves out in the workplace are discussed, identified, discussed. And probably the most important part is that there's some action taken as a result of the findings. It does little good to have a detailed report about something or someone if there's no action that's taken, if it's warranted, of course.
David, what are some of the ethical considerations during a hospital active shooter event?
Well, in a healthcare environment, it gets to be a little dicey, and it's understandable. If you think about who it is that are the healthcare providers, the caretakers, often, as in my line of work, you know, we take an oath to provide service. Doctors and nurses do the same thing. There's an oath that needs to be taken. So, you know, they practice an advocation as well as their vocation. I think that's important to keep in mind. The ethical considerations really come down to, in the gravest extreme, when you only have moments to decide, are you in a position to step away from, in some cases, patients or visitors or contractors to be able to separate yourself from the violence, the active shooter in this case? I've interviewed a lot of people after situations like this, and they feel compelled to protect and save people, save others. And I understand that. But again, in a proactive sense, people need to discuss and come to the decision in advance. Does it make more sense to separate yourself? In the law enforcement, we call it a reactionary gap. Do you increase the reactionary gap so that you can not fall victim to an active shooter, knowing that an active shooter situation only lasts from 2 to 12 minutes typically, and that you'll be able to make it back to the patient? Those are deep-seated and almost spiritual questions that somebody needs to go through in advance.
David, what key details should be included in the organization's active shooter response plan?
Again, and not to be too redundant, but I guess I can't state it enough. What is it that gets reported and how? If there's an event that plays itself out, if it's an actual event that speaks for itself, but if it's perceived, if there's a notion that something's happened, or if there are facts and circumstances that are beginning to develop in front of someone or a group of people that lend them to believe that there might be violence pending, what is it that gets reported? And when does it get reported? Are there mechanisms in place that have been predetermined that are the path of least resistance to be able to get information rapidly disseminated? How is law enforcement notified? How is hospital security notified? What systemic series of events are set in motion based on somebody making that call? That there's somebody standing in front of me, or I just witnessed somebody come in with a gun and shoot someone. More importantly, maybe is proactively again, are there designated safe areas in a facility, or are there not? More times than not, there aren't, but it's important to be able to identify those early. Do people make their way to marshalling areas? When you separate yourself from the violence, how far away do you get and how quickly? A lot of that is situational. It also depends on physical ability. And so we understand that. But where is it that you go to? Do you just scatter? Or is there some place that we marshal up so that we can determine who made it out safely and who didn't? So there are any number of techniques that work. There are any number of modifications to the techniques that work. We've heard about run, hide, fight for some time now. We've heard about ALICE in terms of being able to have a systemic approach to being safe in the gravest extreme. But how do those things really work? And we can expand on that if we have time, but it's not as simple as just run, hide, and fight. There are other considerations.
Many healthcare systems have participated in the ALICE training program. Is this the most common active shooter response plan? What other trainings do you see healthcare systems adopt?
ALICE is good training. Systematic training for active assailant, active shooter response is good. ALICE, for those that don't know, stands for alert, lockdown, inform, counter, evacuate. We can add to that the precursor is run, hide, and fight. ALICE is good, but I want to go back to what I mentioned early on in our discussion today. No one is an expert. No one entity is a cookie cutter approach to all acts of violence. They're all situational. They happen very quickly. And ALICE is good training. Absent no training, ALICE is certainly a good technique to be trained in. But again, ALICE is built off run, hide, fight. And believe it or not, run, hide, fight was adopted corporately. It didn't come from state or federal government, even though that's where all the material seems to have been generated as of late. But it actually came from a corporate development some years ago. But it does work, but it does have limitations as well.
David, these events can be very traumatizing. What advice do you have for when police arrive on the scene?
Sure. It's understandable. They're very, very traumatizing. Not many people are prepared to face events of the gravest extreme like this. When law enforcement arrives, law enforcement tactics have changed over the years, but the short version of what people must try to do, some of it is almost overly simplistic, but nevertheless important. People need to try to remain as calm as they can, and they need to follow the instructions that they're given by officers. Now, a lot of times under extreme stress, people don't hear things appropriately or clearly, so they need to really work at thinking about that in advance. When law enforcement gets there, just listen to the instructions. You need to raise your hands immediately and keep your hands visible at all times. You really need to avoid making quick movements towards the officers or attempting to run and hold on to them. I've been involved in incidents where people are so terrified that once you get there, they feel like they've been saved and they want to run up to you and cling on to you. And that's understandable, but it's deadly in terms of what law enforcement is trying to do. Try to avoid screaming or yelling. And this one gets lost in translation sometimes. Don't stop to ask officers for help or directions. You need to be prepared for officers to walk right past you because their mission is to find and stop the shooter. They'll come back and assist to the best of their ability, but when they first get there, they have to stop the shooter. You may need to be prepared to attend to your own injuries, and you may need to just understand that law enforcement is now on scene, and they're there to save everybody, and they're going to do their very, very best, and they're highly trained, but you just need to know that they're not going to be able to stop and attend to each and every person that may be injured.
David, what would be your advice for civilians when law enforcement arrives on the scene of an active shooter?
Probably the best advice I can give our listeners is this. You have to have a personal action plan first. I've been told that there's a proverb out there that planning is essential, but plans are useless. Everybody has a plan until something goes amiss. So everybody has to have a personal action plan, and these are very, very unique because each and every one of us is different. Probably the point I like to drive home for people is to strip away some of the myth with these things. And it starts with this. You'll not ever create or innovate anything under extreme stress. None of us will. None of us actually rise to the occasion. If you watch a lot of TV or if you watch a lot of Hollywood-based movies, you'll think that you will, but you won't. You will act only as you have trained or practiced. And when you do practice these things, as a sidebar, you have to practice at the speed of life, as we call it. You have to walk through things first, determine what you may or may not be able to do, but then you need to pick up speed and be able to do it as quickly as you'll need to if someone's pointing a gun at you. Have to fight the notion of everything is okay till it's not. You must be prepared, not paranoid. If you believe, if you conduct your life where everything is just okay till it's not, you're already behind the curve. One of the acronyms we use in law enforcement, public safety training, and for personal security is a series of the letter P. There are six P's, and they stand for proper prior planning prevents poor performance, which simply means you have to be your own advocate. If you fail to plan these things, if you fail to think about them until they occur, you'll fail. As a step down from that, you have to have a plan for the worst and hope for the best, not the reverse. You have to have a plan for the worst case scenario and just hope for the best. If you reverse that, again, you'll fall victim. A little cliche that I coined some time ago is you need to believe in statistics. They really don't lie. Statistical averages don't lie, so don't become a fugitive from the law of averages. These events do happen. Just because they haven't happened to you doesn't mean that they won't. Even more specifically, and for us as individuals, you have to train yourself to look for and see a potential threat. Just don't look at someone as an example. Look for a potential threat that someone might pose. And that really begins with looking at somebody's hands. If someone's going to hurt you, they're going to hurt you with their hands or something they're holding in their hands. You have to believe that there's always something you can do. I've taken any number of witness statements and interviewed people in these horrific situations, and I can't tell you how many times I have had to write down and hear this next sentence. I couldn't believe what was happening, and there was nothing I could do. You have to believe that something like this might happen. Not will, but might. And there's always something that you can do. So your personal action plan must merge with any organizational plans that you have, no matter how complex they are, because none of them will work if you freeze and submit to blind panic. And if I could finish up with an expansion on the run, hide, fight notion, run, hide, fight speaks for itself. But I ask people this, where are you running to? What are you running from? Are you running from a person? Are you running from a sound? Are you running from the notion that somebody might be there? Have you pre-planned your route? Are you prepared to leave all of your belongings behind except your cell phone? Are you prepared to move multiple times or just once? When we talk about hide, obviously we hide in the area out of sight of the active shooter. But here's something that concerns me. People are feeling that they're safe just because they're concealed. If you're concealed, you're hidden. The shooter can't see you. But if you're covered, that means that you're protected from gunfire. There's a big difference. Then we have to ask ourselves, how long are we prepared to stay there? We know we must lock the doors and block the entrance. We turn all of the lights off, remain as quiet as possible, and you have to make sure all cell phones are silenced. You need to stay hidden until law enforcement finds you. Now, this next piece might be a little uncomfortable, but it's nevertheless the truth. What if you're discovered? If you're hiding, and what if you're discovered by an active shooter? Negotiating or pleading for your life is historically ineffective. We train people to fight for your life rather than plead for your life. And if you decide to fight, it's the most dangerous response, certainly, but you need to try to incapacitate the shooter as best you possibly can. Act with extreme physical aggression, but you have to ask yourself these things in advance. Can and will you fight? Have you ever had to fight in your life? What's your physical stature? It plays a part. Do you have access to a weapon? And I don't necessarily mean a firearm, but a weapon. Are you trained and confident that you will act? People have to ask themselves in the bottom line, if you get into a fight, if you get into this thing, will you win it? So I like to add those qualifiers to the simple run, hide, fight issue.
David, those were excellent tips. It was a pleasure to have you join our podcast today. You have provided us with insights for active shooter preparedness that I trust our listeners will find useful. Thank you for listening to the AXA-XL Healthcare Risk Insights podcast. Stay tuned for future podcasts where we will dive into other current and developing risks impacting the healthcare industry.